was losing my watch.
Mitch, I thought you were going to sing Good Morning.
That's next. That's the official song.
Okay, good morning, colleagues.
Good morning.
On this Monday morning, March 18th, 2013. Yes, it is Monday morning.
Monday.
Hope you all.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Hope you all had a great weekend. I can tell it didn't last long enough.
That's very true.
But we're off to a new week, and Rep. Wisman is excited, I'm sure, about the brackets for the NCAA. And,
didn't win the championship, but yeah, they're in the big dance.
Oh, well.
Thank you.
Anyway, enough asides. So today we're going to be focusing on healthcare workforce issues, colleagues. We had originally intended to extend the healthcare workforce to include veterinarians. We had a veterinary loan repayment program bill, House Bill 2623. We're not going to be hearing this bill today, so we're just going to be focusing on humans today, I believe. And we're going to start off with an informational hearing on healthcare workforce issues. So I will open this informational hearing, and I'm going to call up Dr. Ann Malosh and Dr. Joe Israig, please.
Well, good morning, Chair and representatives. My name is Ann Malosh, and I am Vice Chair of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Committee, and I'm also an academic dean at Lynn Benton Community College. I have two goals for the little bit of time that we have up here with you today. Well, first, let me stop and introduce Dr. Joe Israig, who is the Executive Director of Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute, and the brains behind the data that we'll be sharing with you. So I have two goals for the time with you this morning. One is to give you an overview of the Oregon healthcare workforce currently, and secondly, to update you on the work that the Oregon Workforce Committee has been up to this past year. So first, to remind you of the charter of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Committee's charter is to coordinate efforts in the state to create, recruit, and retain qualified healthcare professionals, and really staying in front of changing delivery methods and changing work in the profession, to really have our eyes on the data, to have the eyes on kind of the cutting edge needs in the state of Oregon. So first, to talk a little bit about the Oregon, the current state of the state of Oregon, kind of the what's influencing demand, is first we will be having a large number of insured population starting in 2014 that we have, and we're all feeling it, a growing, aging, diversifying population, as well as an aging healthcare population or healthcare employee population. That we don't have an even distribution of healthcare providers throughout the state. There are places in Oregon that we've got too many, and we have many places who don't have enough. And that we do have projected growth in healthcare in the industry down the road, and that reimbursement changes are lagging. Again, no surprise to you. So the current workforce picture, again, not a lot of change between 2000.
You will tell us somewhere where there's those too many.
Pardon?
Just to put on the agenda. You say there are places where there are too many. Mm-hmm. Somewhere, I hope we'll talk about that.
Yes, and remind me if I don't forget. I'll give you one right now. In the Valley, we have an overabundance of nurses. In the Valley, I-5 corridor. We just need to get them to rural and frontier Oregon, and then we'll be better off.
We talked about that one, too.
Okay. Sounds good. So, again, we do have some professions that are increasing, as you can see on the PowerPoint slide. Occupational therapists, physical therapists, they're growing. And with those growth also then come the assistants. So occupational therapy assistants and physical therapy assistants are also growing. Physician assistants and registered nurses have seen a growth in the past couple years. These are all good things. But then there are things that aren't so good and actually are quite scary in some parts of Oregon. We have a decline in dentists. You can see a decline in physicians and a decline in certified nursing assistants. And again, a CNA is one of the first steps into a healthcare occupations, especially in nursing. So a decline isn't something that is a good thing. To drill down a little bit more with the primary care practitioner decline, you'll notice that, again, 2.9% net reduction in the primary care practitioners, 7.8% in primary care physicians, again, which is a problem, 2.1% in physician assistants and 19.3% in nurse practitioners. Of the 36 counties in Oregon, you'll see that 22 have lost primary care practitioners. And again, with that aging workforce, as you see on the slide, that we have got a good percentage of healthcare professionals who are over the age of 65. So we in Oregon, we are doing some things to target these declines. And one, as you see in the first bullet, that with the state's Medicare waiver, we're committed to $2 million loan repayment to encourage those primary care professionals to practice in rural parts of Oregon. Our committee, the Healthcare Workforce Committee, which we'll get to in just a moment, we're developing a provider recruitment program or plan. We are working on changing the way care is delivered, again, trying to embrace technology. And if there is a physician in Portland who can work with a nurse in Pendleton, again, that helps us meet all of the state's needs. So trying to be smarter with technology. And then as part of the Affordable Care Act, the Medicaid primary care providers are receiving increased reimbursements in 2013 and 2014. So now talking a little bit about the work of the Workforce Committee, we've got a few priorities. And the first one, an incredibly important one, is we're really working on trying to prepare our healthcare workforce for the new models of care. We're trying to be out in front, kind of dusting off our crystal ball to see how our practitioners and practice changing with healthcare reform. One example of that would be the committee's work on the expanding role of community healthcare workers and personal navigators, those type new emerging occupations. The committee has been working on competencies for those, training requirements, and kind of diving into helping, again, our state and our educational institutions be ready for the growth of those areas. Again, another priority of ours is to improve the distribution and the capacity of all healthcare workers. Again, trying to be smart. Using technology is one way we're doing that. And if we have a program in the Valley that we can distribute to a smaller community in Eastern Oregon or Southern Oregon, that helps us not oversaturate any one market, but it does provide students the education they need. Because what we do know is when students are educated, when they have to leave their community to go to school, they oftentimes don't come back. So we're trying to allow them to stay in their community and then receive the support that their community has. And another focus of the committee really is to use education, training, and regulatory reform to continue with making good projections, making good connections with K-12, with higher education, again, so we get the right workforce in the right spots in Oregon.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Vice Chair Huffman.
Dr. Mosh, can you expand on that? what your work with K-12 and higher ed is?
Mm-hmm.
How involved do you get in trying to make sure that the funnel at the top is just the right size? Because I'm seeing problems in that, and I'm trying to figure out who to pounce on.
Right. So again,
you're probably not it, so you can feel safe to respond.
So what I neglected to tell you is the Workforce Committee does make recommendations to the Oregon Health Policy Board. And so we give them suggestions and then hope that they can, again, institute changes and reform that will help support. One of the recommendations is just as simple as including healthcare in STEM initiatives. because STEM initiatives get funding, there are grant opportunities, there's lots of connections that way, and if we're able to do that, then again, we have a little bit more focus on healthcare. Another thing that the Workforce Committee is doing, the Workforce Committee is made up of people in education, both K-12 and in higher education. They're made up of physicians and dentists and just the variety of practitioner that we have in Oregon. And so from all those people coming together, we're able to, you know, kind of subtly reach out. But just another example would be kind of helping get information, career information into the K-12, into middle school, into grade school. So many students or children right now think that their healthcare options as a profession are, of course, doctors, nurses. So just trying to help them become more informed. Creating pathways is another example of things that we're trying to do. We're creating educational modules that build on themselves. So if a student can take a CNA program or a nursing assistant program in high school, then when they graduate from high school, they're already one step along the way. Continue with some of their prereqs in the community college, and then again, launch seamlessly into the bachelor's and master's and doctorate program. So there are small things that we're doing, but certainly we could be doing a lot more.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Can you give me an idea of the Workforce Committee and the Health Policy Board? Are you guys connected, and who do you work under? Do you work under CCWD, the governor's office? Where do you fit into the scheme of things?
Want to take that one?
Sure.
Could you identify yourself, Joe, please, for the record?
Chair Dimbro, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Joe Isgrig. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Healthcare Workforce Institute, and I have the honor of working with the Healthcare Workforce Committee and the Oregon Office for Health Policy and Research. The committee is a legislatively created committee under House Bill 2009 from the 2009 legislative session, and it reports up to the Oregon Health Policy Board, who are appointed by members by the governor.
The Health Policy Board is the overseeing board for the Oregon Health Authority.
Okay.
So it
okay.
Has overall,
thank you for
overall
that.
Responsibility.
And you all have Rep. Greenlick and me to blame for this committee from 2009.
I was getting to that, Mr. Chair.
I knew it.
Actually, I'd like to follow up, Dr. Malash, with you talked about the education reform, but how about the regulatory reform? What would be some examples of that? That's tied to the idea of people practicing at the top of their licensure, perhaps?
So the ones that come to mind for me would be adverse impact. So possibly this isn't answering your question. One of the pieces of work that the committee is doing is creating standardized prerequisites for healthcare students. You know, right now, and again, that's one of the slides down the road. Right now, oftentimes students in healthcare programs will go to 4, 5, and 6 different clinical or hospital sites, each one requiring a different set of criminal background checks, a different set of drug immunizations, a different set of HIPAA, those type trainings. So they're continuing to repeat. So what the Workforce Committee is doing is that we've convened over the past year and a half about 70 different institutions to talk about could we all get on the same page with prerequisites for students. And right now we are in the final stages of creating, recommending what that might look like, and having all the different risk managers of the different healthcare facilities come to an agreement, and then to share a database. So that'd be one thing. Another example would be adverse impact. I'm sure many of you are aware that right now, public institutions, private institutions, and for-profit tend to have a different set of rules when it comes to creating new programs. So through a small change in statute and administrative rule, we are recommending that we all have the same type of standards when it comes to informing one another that we're thinking about a new program, and also the same labor market study that needs to be done for each program. So there are two examples of what we're trying to do regulatory in the kind of stream of regulatory change.
Thank you. Rep. Huffman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Dr. Malash, I appreciate that. Because I'm about 2 seconds away from dropping a bill to force that to happen. And so it's nice to know that those conversations are going on. I'm frustrated that we're a year and a half, 2 years into the conversation, and we still have numerous students in Oregon that are completing healthcare prereqs, heading toward a nursing degree, applying to two or three nursing programs, not getting in. They drop out because they have to go get a job. I'm not sure how good the advising end is to give them a different healthcare career track based on the prereqs that they've attained to that point. So they drop out having used probably a significant amount of Oregon Opportunity Grant. It ends in no degree. It only ends in student debt, and it's extremely frustrating to the adult students out there. And I think we've got a huge problem on our hands. Mm-hmm. And I really, one of my focuses this session was to come in and get this fixed. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to get that on the record that.
Can I comment on that, Mr. Chair?
Yes, please, Representative.
The interesting thing about the nursing workforce is in fact, we have expanded the programs for. Nursing, it's far more slots for students to get into, but the models that define the set that there were going to be a big shortage of nursing in Oregon failed because the estimates of how many were going to retire was wrong based on the ability of nurses to retire because of the pension. It's definitely a temporary situation. I mean, that's why I was really worried about the sense that we have too many nurses. In fact, nurses can find jobs. Maybe in long-term care or maybe in other places, but there are jobs. But the fact is, that shortage is going to come. We just moved that cliff a little bit. So I don't think the instructions were wrong that this is an important field. And in fact, it's always been really hard to get into a nursing program. But now I think we have, about 25% more nursing slots than we did? Some number like that just a very few years ago, and we're going to need them without a doubt within 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Response, so, Mr.
Okay, please.
I agree completely. It's just there are going to be a few to several years of students here that are getting screwed over. You know, they weren't told that
education term.
Their year to 2 years of prereqs and all the pre-work might not end the way they anticipated. So I think we've got a weakness in advising, for one. And then I'll just throw this out and then shut up for a minute. But that may be all we can count on.
Yeah.
The nursing programs, I have
question.
A real frustration that, and I'm not an RN, but my observation is that a two-year RN goes to work anywhere in Oregon. They can go to work at a hospital or a clinic or a nursing home or whatever. But all of our nursing programs, and you mentioned you're working on this, they're not necessarily aligned. They don't necessarily feed into each other. And we have two programs out here now, at least two, ITT and Sumner, that are kind of islands unto themselves. And you get nurses that finish prereqs at Chemeketa can't get into a nursing program. They get on at one of the others, and they don't find out till they're halfway through that, oh my gosh, I wanted to do a baccalaureate degree in nursing, and now I have to do it within this program because it doesn't feed into anything else. And I cannot understand how we can have oversight of nursing programs, for example, since we're talking about healthcare, and yet we allow island programs out here that very little feeds into, and then they don't feed out to hardly anything. Thank you.
I would like us to talk more about the public versus private, professional schools. If we can come back to that, why don't you do your, move on with your presentation. We'll come back to that because I have some questions as well. Puffman.
Your question.
Thank you.
So in February, the Workforce Committee did go to the Oregon Health Policy Board with some recommendations from 2013. And just to briefly go through those, the first one, again, is to do a better job aligning resources in K-12 and higher education. Again, going back to the STEM initiative, those type things, going for grants and other funding opportunities together, not as competitors. Another example, and Representative Huffman, this might make you feel a little better. I'm at the community college, and so I'm speaking as a community college dean. We have the healthcare deans have organized. We organized about two years ago. We meet regularly now, and it truly is to work together on programs. So students can move from one program to the other, not having to start over. So we can be smarter about what programs that we're creating and using distance education. If we create one program at Mount Hood, and if that program then commits to distributing that education throughout Oregon, we don't have to have four of those same programs. We're looking at labor market needs in each community, and we're having real conversations. So as 17 community colleges, which used to be very competitive in healthcare anyway, we really are trying to work together as opposed to compete. So I'm optimistic that we'll get somewhere with that. And it's called, it's the healthcare, I can't remember what our name is, we just changed it, but the Community College Healthcare Education Alliance. So a second recommendation to the Health Policy Board, again, is to continue to push for payment reform that supports the different change in delivery, the different coordinated care organizations, the different patient-centered homes, that we really are keeping up with where Oregon's trying to go with healthcare reform. And again, to expand the data collection in Oregon. Right now, Joe has done a wonderful job of getting almost all of our licensing boards now to report data. You know, where are they practicing? How long do they feel they'll be practicing? When do they think they'll be retiring? And we want to expand that to all different licensed professions. This really going to help us make better projections for the future, and then in order to be able to really have the workforce ready.
Sure.
Yes,
have a question, please. Thank you, Chair. My question has to do with the STEM and the, you know, aligning resources in terms of K-12. You know, there's a lot of support in terms of resource contribution by the tech industries. I mean, can we anticipate the same kind of partnership from the healthcare industries? I mean, hospitals, Kaiser, for example, or other large hospitals. Is that something we can anticipate?
Yes, definitely. In my area right now, the large healthcare provider, Samaritan Health Services, and they're a huge provider of both faculty, of resources, of facilities. I mean, they pay for two of my faculty positions in nursing, so I do think we will be able to.
Great, thank you.
Yeah, Rep. Gallegos, when we were working on this 4 years ago, the healthcare industry was actually out in the forefront, in my experience, beyond actually the engineering field, in terms of focus, you know, supporting the needs of the workforce and developing from within and those kinds of things. I will want to ask you some questions of, are we continuing to move forward in those areas?
Yeah. Thank you.
A few more slides. So during the presentation to the Health Policy Board, the board did ask the Workforce Committee to take on a very specific and more detailed piece of work, and that really is to focus on, to create a strategic plan for primary care providers and how we're going to be able to create and to grow those in Oregon. So the Workforce Committee is currently working on a five-year strategic plan, and we hope to be back at the Health Policy Board in April to share our recommendations there. So we do have further work in that area.
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Rick Lima.
Can I just put a number on that? Currently we have about 650,000 people in the Oregon Health Plan. The expectation is that we'll add about another 225,000 people to that 650. And at the same time, the exchange will be opening up, and we expect to have at least another couple hundred thousand having health insurance. So all of a sudden you've got almost 500,000 more people in the state with financial access to care. It doesn't mean they have access to care, though. But I think that's the kind of magnitude of the problem we're going to be facing in terms of those numbers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just to follow up, and when we get back to the question of where we may be oversubscribed right now, you know, do the models for that, you know, take into account, you know, A, the retirements that, as Rep. Greenlich mentioned, may be postponed but should be coming, as well as the increased need, you know, with the access to health care.
So So I think I've touched on most of these, but just briefly regarding the other activities of the committee or activities that we started a few years ago that we continue. Again, the first one is that House Bill 2366, that primary provider recruitment. So again, looking at growing our own strategies, how do we educate in the state of Oregon, keeping health professionals in the state of Oregon? How do we recruit from outside of Oregon? How do we show that Oregon is a wonderful destination, a great place to work, to raise a family, and again, to help our community? And then also to help support communities, businesses come together to be able to recruit together. So again, a lot revolving around marketing. And then the second one, and I've already talked a little bit about that one, again, standardizing the prereqs for students. What we really are looking for, in my dream, a student is wearing a passport, and it has all the data, all the trainings they've been to, all the immunizations they have, the background checks, everything that tells the hospital or the clinic they are good to practice here. The hospital wants to know, they swipe the badge, they have all the information right there. So students do it one time, and it's good through their career as a student. So again, that's the work we're close to actually being done with that one. And then adverse impact. So we started working with the Office of Degree Authorization, used them as a little bit of, to get some, to gather information, and then invited the for-profits, the privates, and the public institutions to the table a variety of times, probably three or four times, to really talk about how can we work together on program development? How can we not compete? So again, right now we have a letter to the Higher Education Coordinating Council. We sent it back in August. And again, it's recommending a small statute change and a small administrative rule change that, again, would require all educational institutions to do a labor market study and to notify all other institutions that they're going to create a program. The hope is that that creates dialogue and that allows us to not oversaturate the market, but also make sure that we educate in places of Oregon where we need to educate. So we're hopeful for that one also.
Actually, if I can interrupt, related to that, we will be hearing a bill a week from today, House Bill 3341, which seeks to eliminate the adverse impact statute here in Oregon.
Mm. So again, just to sum up, our work truly is to help, to assist in creating a workforce in Oregon, a healthcare workforce in Oregon that's going to meet the needs. It's a quality, highly skilled, trained professionals. They're going to meet the emerging demand that our population will require in a few years. We really are focused on getting better data so we can make better projections, analyze, so that we're able to know what parts of Oregon need what type of healthcare professionals. And again, it takes a lot of it takes work by those that are thinking about it, dreaming it every day, to help us make projections. And then again, back to the same old conversation, to push payment reform, to have it keep up with our different healthcare delivery reform here in Oregon. So that's all I have, and would be more than happy, both Joe and I, to answer questions that you have.
Sure. Yes, Representative Greenland.
I was on the board of the Northwest Health Foundation for 10 years or so, and we helped form something that was called the Nursing Leadership Council or something like that. Is that still involved, and do you work with them?
I don't have a recollection
myself. The deans of the nursing schools and...
Yes, Chair Jimbro, Representative Greenlake, yes, that group is still meeting, and with the help of the Oregon Center for Nursing, there's a lot of effort that group is working on. A lot of topics that group is working on.
Rep. Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for your presentation. Yes, I have three short questions. Dean, what is your relationship with the OSHU Nursing School? Do you have a close working relationship with them?
Currently, Lynn Benton Community College is not a partner with OHSU. There are some nursing programs who are not connected with what I believe is called OCNI curriculum. We are not a member.
Yeah. Joe, could you talk more about OCNI?
Actually, Ann might be able to talk.
So I want to say that there are the majority of community college nursing programs are part of OCNI, and that is a very seamless transition from the two-year program into OHSU's four-year bachelor's program. There are a few colleges, Lynn Benton being one, Chemeketa in Oregon, or Central Oregon Community College being another, that are not currently a part of OHSU. We do have connections with Lynn Field and other bachelor's programs that our students go to.
Thank you.
Yeah, let me just follow up. And so why is Lynn Benton not part of OCNI?
That decision was made before my time with the nursing program. I've been with them now for 7 years. And some of it at the time had to do with restrictions, lack of flexibility. That has changed over time, and we have actually had conversations at my college. Is it time? And also, OCNI does allow all the colleges to attend their meetings, so it isn't exclusive to just OCNI schools. Everyone can attend and hear the information and have a conversation. It's just that our students they're not able to seamlessly move to OHSU.
My second question is that, thank you for that information. What I was really looking for is several sessions ago, it became obvious that we needed more nurses with master's degrees to help solve the problem, because we had classes available, had students available, we had no instructors. So we passed a bill to help, I think, forgive loan or reduce the loan or something to go through and get your master's if you went back and taught. Do you know if that's helping? Is that, are you having enough instructors in the community colleges to teach nursing?
We have noticed, and there's probably a variety of reasons, we have noticed that it is easier to recruit nurses, that we've got a deeper pool, that they're very highly qualified. Many students, we had the conversation in the ADN program, you know, continue with your education. So we do believe we're seeing the benefit of that. And also because of the recession, there are more job opportunities.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to see if we can find Mrs. Cox, if we could find out are we getting people applying? We passed the bill and see how.
Yeah, I'm just looking at my notes. That was Senate Bill 701,
yeah.
The Nurse Faculty Loan Repayment Program.
And
I'm not sure that we put money into it, though. Is that?
Well, I think you had to apply. I don't know we put it in. We just did have to apply first and then, or to go through the process, I thought, the way the bill read.
That was designed to repay the graduate education of a full-time nurse, one-fifth of their loan for each of the 5 years that the faculty member teaches. So, you know, I'm just not sure that there was actually money to do that. Do you know, Joe?
Representative Jimbrough, Chair Jimbrough, you're bringing up some gaps in my memory there, so I need to go back and check, and
we'll
report back to you.
Yes. Rep. Greenlick, you don't know, do you? I got that one.
The final question, Mr. Chair. We see, and especially in rural and eastern Oregon, about use of television you bring a patient into a facility and you have a television where you can access a doctor. Is that being done in any of your training?
Yes, it is. In diagnostic imaging, we are actually doing student assessment through video conferencing. So for the education-wise, anyway, we are definitely using that. Now we've got enough bandwidth to actually have HD views, so it does make. There were times when, you know, my staff would be on the road for days and days and days because they'd have to attend each of the facilities to do assessment. Now it's an hour.
But in follow up, Mr. But also, are your students being taught how, you know, where they have to do the camera, how they have to interplay with the patient and the doctor in a remote? So that's part of your curriculum.
Yes, it is.
Thank you.
And does the Oregon Simulation Alliance still exist?
Yes, it does.
Could you say something about that, how that works, especially in rural areas, right?
So my experience with the Oregon Simulation Alliance is it's helped us with training faculty on simulation, and it also has helped us in making strategic and smart purchases of simulation equipment, which, as you know, is incredibly expensive. So they are still our vendor, and they're still offering training. And what's nice is they've also moved much of their training to an online format. So again, we're not having to have everyone in Oregon drive to a specific location. A lot of it is just done virtually, which is helpful.
Yes, sir, of course, sir.
Could we go back to the geography question?
Yes, of course.
That Rep. Greenlick brought up in terms of places where there's too much and places where there's too little, just a general overview of that.
Go for it.
Do you want to talk about in the valley? So what we're able to see now through the data collected, and I know that geography is a passion of yours.
That's true.
What we're able to see through the data that we're collecting through the licensing boards is exactly where people are working, where their practice address is, and then in addition, how many hours they're working and how many hours they're engaged in direct patient care. So we know we have areas, particularly down I-5 and in the Portland metro area, where we have an abundance of training programs, also an abundance of some of the graduates of those programs that are staying in that area. But when we get out to our smaller communities, for example, in Sherman and Wheeler County, those counties lost 50% of their primary care practitioners. Sherman County had 2, now they have 1 primary care practitioner. Wheeler County had 4, now they have 2 primary care practitioners. So we know we have some issues in terms of distributing our currently trained workforce out where they're particularly needed. So working with the, for example, the Community College of Healthcare Deans Alliance to do some of the work through distributive education helps to train people out in those communities so we can actually get the training and distribute that training out into those rural communities where they're needed. And that helps with some of the distribution of our workforce.
Thank you. Can I comment?
Yes, please.
We'll have a bill on the floor this week to help insurance companies recognize they should be paying those independent rural practice primary nurse practitioners at an adequate rate. Part of the issue is the insurance companies decided to cut all their rates recently. Didn't help that, and it certainly doesn't help in the future, so that's something we're trying to work out.
Can I just jump in? I noticed in the statistics that we have seen an increase in the number of nurse practitioners in the state, but a decrease in physician assistants. Can you explain that? Is there an explanation for that?
Chair Deborah, I'm not sure I have a good explanation, but I can explain a little bit of that. There's a couple of pieces there. One is the way the data is collected. For the Oregon Medical Board, ask the physicians and the physician assistants what their specialty practice area is. For our nurse practitioners, they're not asked that specific question, so we have to go by their certifications. And so if they're certified in a particular area that's identified as primary care, that's how we identify them as a primary care practitioner. They may not be actually providing primary care. They may be focusing in on a particular piece of adult care or child care. But so that's the best information that we have now. The other piece in that is that nurse practitioners not that long ago went from being a master's trained to now to a doctoral trained and prepared practitioner. So we did have a little bit of a gap as we transitioned, as education programs transitioned to that. So we're actually seeing now more people come back into our identified as nurse practitioners since we've had that transition. And then the third part is the opportunity that Oregon has a broader scope of practice for nurse practitioners than in other states, and it may be that we have a recruitment advantage over other states for new nurse practitioners.
Yes, Vice Chair Huffman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. A few questions.
Yeah.
On the OCNI alignment, why do we have 2 different tracks, and how can we get on the same track? Because I'm focused on the nursing student, in case you couldn't tell. The nursing student, I don't think, largely understands or cares. They just see the potential of having a nursing career, making a family wage, and supporting their family. And yet we convolute that, and it's not fair to the student. Are you headed toward alignment, or what's preventing us from having a system where a nursing program is a nursing program is a nursing program?
Well, Representative Huffman, We'd also like to give students options, and I appreciate what you said regarding advising, and I do feel advising is truly the majority of the problem when it comes to nursing and nursing students and following a path that will get them to their goal or their destination. But it is nice to have options for students. Currently at Lynn Benton, we are working with the medical school in Pomona, our medical school in Lebanon. They have a ADN to master's program for nursing, just skips the bachelor's. And so we're really interested in that as a potential option for students so that they don't, again, have to find a bachelor's program in Oregon. So I think as long as students are advised, you know, they can have different options that are going to typically meet their current life situation, as opposed to just having one size fits all. This is how the healthcare deans in the community colleges are looking at nursing right now.
Let me just jump in. Okay. You know, I know that, you know, one of the things that Rep. Huffman is concerned about is the sort of disconnect between the public schools and the private schools, where, you know, the public schools, you know, many of them are aligned with ACNI and, you know, are trying to come up with common standards in a lot of ways. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that's changed in the nursing profession in the last 5 years or so is that a number of private schools have been initiated here, for-profit schools. And there's kind of a disconnect, right? I mean, and just as a sort of aside, we are hoping, as we're moving towards the reorganization of post-secondary, to have the Higher Ed Coordinating Commission being charged with oversight or at least coordination of the community colleges, the universities, and the for-profit sector, to perhaps we'll have more of what Rep. Huffman is hoping for. But at the moment, there are large disconnects. Is that correct?
That is correct. And in all honesty, as a community college dean, I have, as I mentioned before with adverse impact, we have absolutely no say if a for-profit wants to come in the community and open an educational institution or school.
And one of the challenges with that, as I understand, so, you know, Rep. Wisnant mentioned that the challenge of faculty, you know, in nursing faculty for advanced nursing, but we also have a problem with clinical placements, right, clinical sites. And so, you know, the new schools that have cropped up are in competition now with existing programs for finding good clinical sites. Can you talk about that and just more largely how the nursing schools are coping with the challenge of finding clinical locations?
Yes, it is a challenge. The two things that restrict our numbers are having enough master's prepared faculty and enough clinical sites. So again, what we're trying to do, some of the hospitals are really working hard to accommodate us with different shifts. We actually now have students in all three of the different shifts, which kind of allows more clinical site opportunities. But what we're trying to do is just create strong relationships, be supportive of our clinical sites, of our hospitals, so in the hopes that they will continue with the relationship. Although I have heard that there are some for-profits who are now offering to pay for clinical spots, and quite honestly, we just can't compete with that. We won't be able to compete with that.
I even heard one instance recently where one of the for-profits told their one cohort of nursing students that they were going to be responsible for getting their own clinicals for their last term. And again, to me, it's just unbelievable that they can be an authorized nursing program in Oregon and not have their stuff together enough to truly have a qualified program. It's amazing. You said you've been collecting a lot of data. I asked Oregon OSAC recently on the opportunity grant, and we've got 40-40-20, and a lot of what you're involved in is the 40-40 part, and that middle 40 is a biggie. And I asked Bob, what's our return on investment? With 40-40-20 and the opportunity grant, how much of that opportunity grant money is not ending in a degree? And statutorily at the state, we have to be very focused because we've got that 40-40-20 now in statute. So have you been able to find how many ex-nursing students finished their prereqs and, again, probably got opportunity grant money, they have student loans, and it didn't end in a degree, so it didn't get us any further down the road on that aspirational 40-40-20. Do you have numbers? Are you tracking that at this point?
I don't have them right now, but I imagine we can get them just through the IPEDS reporting that the community colleges do. We could get that information for you.
And then is there any plan? Have you guys talked on the committee about having community colleges or whomever go back to those students that, you know, had a 3.73 average in their nursing prereqs and go back and re-advise them and say, hey, you know, we realize you didn't make it into a nursing program or for whatever reason you didn't complete a degree program. Have you thought about this, or this healthcare career?
We actually, Lynn Benton is part of our completion agenda activities. That is the one thing we're doing, one of many things we're doing, and that we have what are called academic planning advisors, and they are on the phone or with students every day, all day, looking at those students who completed a certain proportion of prereqs or program, calling them up, how can we help you, how can we get you back in, these are your options, and really educating the planning assistant on all the different health profession opportunities, not just at Lynn Benton, but all the other different educational facilities in Oregon, so student is fully informed. So that is something that we are just starting to launch, actually spring term.
One final question, I promise. At the Lynn Benton Nursing Program, can you tell me how many nursing students start in a cohort? I'm going to call it cohort because some do. I don't know if you all call it cohorts or not, but in a nursing class, how many students start and what's the typical graduation rate out of the program where they can go take their NCLEX? Because there is one program in the state right now, I understand, starts out with, I think it's 22, and on average about 17 of them complete. There's another program that starts out with 30 and typically 10 or 11 complete, and that seems pretty amazing to me. There's something going on there that I'd like somebody to look into, but anyway, what kind of averages are we looking at? Like at Lynn Benton, how many?
So Lynn Benton, each year we take in 48 students, and we typically have 45 that complete the 2 years, and we typically have 95 to 100%, usually 100% pass rate of the NCLEX. What we find in all healthcare professions, at the community colleges anyway, that we have an incredibly high completion rate. They're competitive programs to get into, so we have students who are very focused, have the academic experience to be successful. So we typically have over 90% success rate for students who enter. But that isn't touching those students who try to get in, and there isn't a space for them.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. My question is sort of like two questions that have to do with higher ed. I know that like Pacific, for example, recently started a PhD in physical therapy, I believe. University of Portland started a doctorate recently in nursing. So my two questions are, one, is there really a need for those programs? I mean, are there jobs out there for graduates from these programs? And then secondly, what about the matriculation from the community college into the BA programs and into the doctoral programs? I mean, with the private schools, are we running into the same issues of matriculation as we are with the for-profit schools? Is that anything we need to be concerned about?
Chair Timbro, representing Gallegos. On your first question, the change from the master's prepared practitioners, entry-level practitioners for PTs and nurse practitioners, for example, that's a profession requirement versus an educational choice. So the profession itself has moved it to a higher level degree to be able to enter Pacific's. Does a sig- significant, provides a significant portion of the physical therapists working in our state as well as OTs working in our state as well. There are a lot of jobs for PTs and OTs and nurse practitioners in our state. Right now, so the University of Pacific University and University of Portland are two programs that work very closely within the communities as well as the regional areas to help bring students, particularly those from underserved areas and populations, into programs. So they are actually spending a lot of time and effort towards grabbing those students and helping them matriculate into good careers.
And regarding the second part of your question, we try at the community college to have a relationship with all the potential programs, whether they're private or for-profit, with their advising sheets. So if a student does reach out to an advisor, they can be shown the different type courses they need in order to go to the variety of institutions. It tends to overwhelm students, I have to say, and doesn't necessarily always succeed like the way we want it to.
Thank you.
Let me follow up on that. And if you could say something about the role of the licensing boards in all of this. I mean, presumably this shift to a doctoral level physical therapy and more in for nurse practitioners, that came at the request of the licensing boards. Is that correct? Or, you know, to what extent do the licensing boards sort of dictate the numbers that we're shooting for and the type of degrees that we're aspiring towards?
Chair Dimbro, each of the different professions actually have different accreditation requirements and regulatory requirements, and the boards play different roles in that. The Board of Nursing has a stronger relationship in education in terms of regulating the curriculum or what's involved in terms of clinical placements. The move towards the doctoral prepared or the higher prepared levels are coming from the professions nationally versus the individual state licensing boards. So, but they have to respond to that as well. So they have to change some of the licensing requirements then as well. So does that
yes,
answer
and
your question?
But okay. Also just in terms of you know, working to you know, establish the goals for the numbers of professionals, you know, in the state, that they have a role to play with that too, don't they?
Chair Dimbro, I'm not sure that they're setting benchmarks, but they are. I know the Board of Nursing is closely involved with the nursing educators to address the needs of the state. Other licensing boards are much smaller, where they might just have one or two people working. For example, the board of the licensing board for dietitians is a very small board. Some of which have been. Now fall under the Oregon Health Licensing Agency, so they have each of the boards have different responsibilities when it comes to the workforce development piece of their of the professions.
Mm-hmm. And Chair Dimbro, what we find at the community college is the advisory committees are the ones that have more impact on our numbers, not what we teach, but how many we teach and where we distribute.
And you have a separate nursing advisory committee at Lynn Benton, which looks at your region.
Correct.
And so, if you were to have too many nurses in your region, the nursing board would tell you, "Hey, don't expand," or you know, you may not want to be turning out so many nurses. Is that right? I mean, I'm kind of following up on Rep. Huffman's question.
So in my experience, the accrediting body, OSBN, does not tell us not to expand.
Well, what's not true?
That they're told not to expand based on current supply.
Yeah.
Wasn't that the question you asked?
Yes.
I don't think anybody tells them that anymore.
I agree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And if they did, they'd get it wrong. You really need to read Nate Silver's book on prediction.
Well, that's true. But it is true that generally, I know the community colleges do look to their industry advisory committees, as you mentioned, to help guide them in terms of, you know, the particular specialties they should be focusing on and, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Well, Mr. Chair, I mean, it takes a long time to gear up for these kind of programs. And the notion that looking at the data today based on a model today, I mean, it would just be the wrong direction to go. I mean, we need to look to the future in some way. And in the future, we have an aging population and we have more people in healthcare and we're going to need. I mean, the answer is, should we shut these down because people aren't getting in? Well, should we shut down medical schools because people are doing pre-med and not getting into medical schools? Well, that's been historically the case, and in fact, we need more medical schools. Fortunately, we have another one here. I mean, I don't think we have a problem of too many of anything. I think we have a problem of too few of anything. Name it, lab techs, whatever you want. PTs who have to get a doctorate now to do the same thing they ever did. I mean, it's crazy. We just don't have enough of any of these personnel.
Okay. Yes.
Chair Dimbrough, just in support of Representative Greenlit's point, what we hear from the Oregon Center for Nursing is that it's taking our nursing students about 6 months to find a job versus having one waiting for them before they came out of school. And some of that is the economy as well. We've got also for our nursing profession, 36% of our RNs are age 55 and over. So we know that as the economy is recovering, that we are going to be experiencing significant retirements, and we need to be able to have the workforce prepared and ready to go to fill those slots when they open up.
And so just to add on to Joe's comment, so we are not decreasing the numbers in our nursing programs. We are just trying to help students understand better what their options are. And still many hospitals, they have openings for nursing staff. It's just they want experience. So right now we're trying to do things like cooperative work experience and other different training programs to give our new graduates the experience they need to be able to enter a hospital. So we are trying to, and we're also trying to keep our nursing student graduates in Oregon. We don't want to lose them because they will be able to find jobs elsewhere. So we are sensitive to the fact that there is going to be a looming shortage. We are not decreasing our numbers. We're just trying to help students find ways to support themselves while they're waiting for that job opening.
Rep. Gallegos.
Yeah, thank you. I'm finding this very interesting, very informative, so thank you for this. Two questions again. Will this, can this be available to us, your PowerPoint? We'd like that very much.
It's on.
Thank you. The other question is, getting into content areas. I mean, do you actually get into content? For example, historically, we've just had a real dearth of professionals working in geriatrics. Is that something you're, as I said, so as a content area, do you also sort of promote that as well?
Yeah. Go ahead.
Each of our different healthcare programs
have
specialty conversations. So pediatrics, geriatrics, those are all part of their instruction, yes.
Thank you.
Try.
I have one last question, and that is, you know, you mentioned as one of the challenges the growing diversity of Oregon's population, and, you know, that leads to, you know, I know you have a longstanding goal of diversifying the healthcare workforce. And one of the programs that I remember from a few years ago was it was called the WIN program, something with immigrant nurses, where, you know, you had health professionals who were physicians or perhaps nurses in other countries who come here, and it puts them on a fast track to get their through proficiency based kind of education to get their licensure. Are we moving forward with that? Is that progressing?
Chair Dimbrough, that program actually still exists at Clackamas Community College, and that was with some help from funding from the Northwest Health Foundation that got underway. There is effort as well to increase the number of underrepresented populations within not just nursing, but within a lot of different mm-hmm. professions. So there is a lot of effort around that.
And how are we doing? Are we making progress?
Well, we still have a long way to go. So the fact that we're paying attention to it is important, but we have seen little increases. We don't have a lot of data yet to show the great increases that we really need to see to see how they represent our population, to see the different groups. But there are programs like the Oregon Center, the Oregon Health Education Center is working with the Aspire program and for community college to do a mentorship program for some of in our rural areas for some of those from underrepresented populations who are interested in healthcare careers. So there are a lot of targeted efforts, and we should start seeing some of the results of that coming out in our data the next time around from the licensing boards.
Okay, thank you. Let's hope so. Okay, thank you both very much for coming in and giving us this status report update, and we may need you back again sometime before the end of the session, but thank you very much. Okay, so with that, I'm going to close this informational meeting on healthcare workforce, and I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2178. And I'll call up Representative Boone and Jim Coffey. And while they're coming up, can you, Victoria, tell us what this bill does?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2178 provides for education loans to students pursuing advanced degrees necessary to manage medical clinics, provides loan forgiveness to such students who agree to manage medical clinics in underserved areas.
Rep. Boone, welcome.
Hi, good morning, Chair Dimbrough and committee. And I'm going to be very brief because I don't want to go into a coughing fit, but I am here to introduce today a constituent of mine and the administrator of a rural health clinic in Astoria, Coastal Family Health.
Excuse me, Rep. Boone, but could you identify
Deborah Boone, House District 32. I always do that.
It's a local custom.
It's a local custom. And Jim's testimony will explain what we're doing here. He came to me last year with the idea for this piece of legislation, and I was very excited to introduce it to you today because this is something that, a good segue from your last segment of this agenda, and as we move forward, he's been very involved in formation of the CCO in our area, and it's the biggest one, so I'm with without further ado, Jim Coffey, and you have to introduce yourself again, from Astoria, Oregon, part of my new district.
Morning. Welcome, I'm Jim Coffey. I'm from Astoria, Oregon. I run Coastal Family Health Center, which is a federally qualified health center in Astoria, serving most of Clatsop County and a portion of Pacific County, which is southwestern Washington. Excuse me. So I want to give you a little bit of my background. I came to Coastal Family Health Center 9 years ago from just outside of Boston, where I worked in a federally qualified health center for about 10 years. Prior to that, I ran the information systems for a large medical imaging company in Los Angeles. So I've been in healthcare practice management for about 30 years, and it's been a really exciting and quite a change over the last, especially 18 months, with the formation of the CCOs and moving into that legislation. So during this time of healthcare transformation, it is imperative to support rural healthcare provider organizations to ensure financial viability and long-term success. Finding and hiring well-qualified administrators is becoming more and more difficult task, requiring nearly full-time efforts. There are many factors in recruiting qualified staff, not the least of which is a sound educational background. Managing a healthcare organization in itself is a very complex proposition. Add to that the era of healthcare transformation, CCOs, lowered reimbursement, retiring medical providers, and the economic downturn, and you have a recipe for disaster. Now is the time to encourage young people and middle managers to continue into higher education in management-related fields. But for many, the prospect of incurring $50,000 to $60,000 of student debt with very high student loan interest rates prevents many from continuing. The federal student loan forgiveness programs do not provide relief for many due to the low salary constraints and the 10-year payment and employment criteria. Medical providers, including physicians, physician assistants, and nurse practitioners, have many avenues for loan relief. For example, Oregon's Rural Health Tax Credit, the National Health Service Core Loan Repayment Program, which pays up to $30,000 per year. These folks leave school with hundreds of thousands of dollars in student debt, but have a much higher earnings to student income debt ratio. Clinic managers and administrators do not have any of these options, and the ratio of debt is often much higher. Rural communities face a growing crisis in recruiting healthcare managers. We are competing with big cities, higher wages, often doubled. I know myself, I could probably make 2 to 3 times what I make if I worked in Portland as opposed to Astoria. So we face local talent out-migration, leaving a void that'll be filled with educationally unqualified candidates. So I want to give you a couple of real-life examples of how things can go wrong. And the first is a really personal story to me because it's a friend of mine, and I don't wish to disparage her personally, but the example is really telling. Sunset Empire Transportation District, which is the local bus system in Clatsop County, the prior director, who had been with the organization for 15 years, had no higher education, only a high school diploma. She was with the organization for 15 years. As the organization grew, the need for well-informed management grew. In 2011, they reached a crisis point. The organization floundered under that management. The director resigned. One half of the employees lost their jobs. The county went from six bus routes running all day, 7 days a week, to 2 bus routes making 2 round trips throughout the county per day. Countless people depended on that, on the bus lines, lost their jobs to transportation issues. The economic impact to Clatsop County was devastating. A new and well-educated director has since been hired and is turning things around, but they still have a long way to go to get back on their feet and to get back where they were. This was an unneeded recovery, and when it is complete, it'll have taken them over 4 years. The second example is not quite so dire. The Women's Resource Center of Clatsop County has long struggled financially under the administration of the prior director, who, again, only had a high school diploma, often just barely able to make payroll, and that is a lot of many nonprofits, not just today, but forever. She recently retired. A new director who has a master's degree was hired to take over the Women's Resource Center and has been working diligently to put the Resource Center on solid financial footing. Nonprofit safety net organizations are often started by passionate, well-meaning community folks who, with the desire to solve a social issue. Many of these organizations fail in the first few years of existence. Please do not allow this to happen to the rural healthcare system in the state of, when the state of Oregon needs them most. I want to give you a quote from one of the nurse practitioners who works for me in Astoria. Her name is Lydia Warner, and she relocated from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, to come work for us out in Astoria. She would like me to tell you that without well-qualified administrators running the clinic that she works in, I would not be able to care for my patients and provide the continuity of care that is desperately needed in rural Oregon. I ask you to support House Bill 2178 as a critical recruitment tool in ensuring the long-term administrative and financial viability of our clinics. And then I would just like to close with, I would like to also strongly encourage you to consider this bill. At this point in time, the healthcare transformation is really, really amazing and complex. I'm actually leaving this meeting to go sit on my computer to be in a board meeting for the CCO for the next 4 hours, helping ensure that We do take care of people that are on the Oregon Health Plan, as well as work towards the beginning of 2014 when the health insurance exchange comes on board and a lot more people end up in the CCOs. So I really do encourage you to support House Bill 2178 and help me help the people in rural Oregon. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cook. Questions? Yes, Rep. Greenlee.
Thank you. It's my impression that schools all over the country are pumping out masters in health administration or whatever it's called. Is there really a shortage in the market? I understand why we might want to help students go that route, but I mean,
No, there's not a shortage in the market for well-qualified, educated people. It's really difficult to get them to move to rural communities.
I see.
I mean,
I hear you.
When
I understand
started,
that.
Okay.
Yeah.
So the bill calls for the rural community is defined as having a population of fewer than 7,500 persons. That's the sort of target that you're looking at, is that right?
And I'd like to butt in here a little bit. That may need to be changed because that is an extremely small area. And the definition is a little fuzzy, in my opinion, the writing here. So I'm looking at an amendment to that effect and tightening that up a little bit and making sure that we are addressing what, because in this case, Astoria wouldn't qualify.
Right.
And I think we're not talking about a clinic or enabling a clinic to open in every small town there is. I think we're talking about regions or something, and Jim was, we were discussing it this morning, there's a federal region of, you know, rural, what was it called again?
Medically underserved area.
Yeah.
MUA.
And that would make sense to use that. Because the point of this is, as he said, it's difficult to recruit to these areas. It's difficult enough to recruit the medical professionals. But as you all know, everybody knows there are certain sectors where you need those people to be doing practicing their magic while somebody else is running the business end of it. And they often can't do both, obviously. And you need to be able to recruit qualified, educated people to, and especially since we're changing this health reform, it's going to be a little bit more difficult than just, you know, writing a few paychecks and making an agenda for the day. So I think that's the point. And the areas, I mean, I know some of you are from rural areas and some of you are not, but as Jim said, and we all know, you make more money in the bigger cities, the bigger areas, and recruitment is key to it. And I just don't want to see this new system come in and have the people in the rural areas settle for, you know, the best of the lot they get. And they should be able to offer good positions to qualified people out there. And I think, Representative Greenlee, you're right, there are a lot of people graduating in health administration. And I would guess a lot of them would want to move to a rural area, but what stops them is the level of compensation and what's there for them as far as, you know, life, they have to support a family. And I know myself, when I moved to where I represent from Portland, I was very limited as to what work I could do. And guess what I ended up in? Public service. So the point is to enable the rural communities to enjoy a quality health delivery system that's run by people who, you know, want to help, but this is another tool for them to be able to not have to be 10, 12 years out in their career and still having a huge debt behind them.
Right. Rep. Wisner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Debbie, Representative Boone, thank you for bringing this bill. Jim, I was shocked this morning in this committee that I understand that from one of the experts on this committee that Oregon Health Plan is going to go from 600,000 to an additional 200,000. Is that the same situation in your district that you expect with this new health care initiative that there'll be that much increase in Oregon Health Plan people you'll be managing?
Yes. and it actually started for us out in our region November 1st because the open card patients were folded into the CCO and we went from 9,000 people in our CCO to almost 15,000 in one day. And in Clatsop County, being the largest local provider, we got an additional 1,000 patients in one day. We didn't see them all that day, but they were added to the rolls of the people we're taking care of.
You didn't tell them at that point they were eligible to go there, so it made it easier to serve.
No.
Representative Gallegos.
Yeah, thank you, Chair. Am I correct, your bill calls for a two-year residence in order to qualify for this loan forgiveness? Is that right?
Quality, yeah. I have to get this.
Is it 1 year? What I'm really curious about is there research or data that supports, you know, a length of time in terms of retention? In other words, is there data that supports the idea that either 1 year or 2 year will keep somebody in a locale, or would they just do that and get their loan forgiveness and then move on?
The National Health Service Corps, which is the federal program for student loan repayment, has an initial requirement of 2 years for medical providers. A big portion of that is based on the fact that they're looking for continuity of care, because people do tend to, once their student loans are paid, tend to move on to somewhere else because it is, once you no longer have the student debt hanging over your head, it's much easier to live in a bigger city at higher costs, those kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so the repayment is, so for each year, it reduces a fifth, but there's a minimum of 2 years to commitment. Another element of it is calls for matching funding from local agencies or community organizations. How do you see that working in Astoria,
Jim? Currently, my organization will pay for an undergrad or graduate degree $1,500 per year per employee. We do have a requirement that they work for us for 1 year beyond payment to them. So they would, each class they go through, they come and they can put in for $300 per course. And that's after they've completed that course. And then we hold them to the obligation that they would stay with us at least for 12 months following that payment. Mm-hmm. So I think that most organizations, it really is not small money, but a little bit definitely helps. I know that the rural health tax credit is huge for me as a recruitment tool for medical providers. And to be able to say to someone that my organization this year has, you know, if I were to tell the young lady who's working on her master's right now that works for me, that if I took her $1,500 and doubled it and then paid her student loans with it, she'd be much happier than the $1,500, and it would spur her on to complete it even sooner.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't think the legislation specifies what the match is. You know, if it's a one-for-one match, it just says that the community provides matching funds. I don't know, Rick Greenlick, do you know how these things work with these, you know, the rural repayment where there is a community participation? I assume that's Harry giving you the answer.
They work differently in different.
So there can be different degrees of match. Okay, thank you.
Sorry about that, Mr. Chair.
No, it's fine. So let me, before I ask you to sit down, we have Susan Dagan from OSEC has some testimony. So why don't you stay there in case there's anything that.
Rep. Gallegos, I cannot find in the bill, maybe I've not seen it, about that requirement. So.
Is it a bona fide?
Yeah, it's at the top of page 2.
It is top of page 2.
The end of section 3.
Oh, is a bona fide member, a resident of the state.
No, it's at the end, the very end of section 3.
Okay. Oh, to amend it? Did that part?
Just above section 4.
Usually, Mr. Chair, the representatives that come in have memorized these bills.
stuff. Hey, cool.
Wow, that was kind of mean.
That's an appropriate comment from my colleague.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a question? Well,
please,
I see what you're saying.
If you're thinking of we have to prioritize it frequently. It's really, I guess, it won't be
1 year for each. Yeah, 2 years.
If this bumps against a bill for getting more primary care providers into your clinics because of this, how does this, in your mind, stand up to the comparison of helping you get nurse practitioners or physicians?
Medical providers would come first.
I think that's the problem we're going to have. This would certainly be useful, there's no question, but if we have to compare it with shortage of loan funds, I think most people will pick giving you your medical care providers. It makes it a lot easier to manage if you have staff. I think that's going to be our problem.
Ms. Dagan.
Sure. For the record, Chair Dembro, Co-Chair Huffman, my name is Susan Deegan. I am the Administrator for State Grants and Government Affairs for the Oregon Student Access Commission, and I'm here today to testify on this bill, so I thank you for the time to speak with you this morning. Just as a tiny bit of background, OSAC administers more than 450 privately funded scholarships. We administer the Oregon Opportunity Grant and a variety of smaller government-funded programs. The Chafee program for foster youth and other small programs. We are also home to the Aspire program, which is a mentoring program for high school students, and we have expanded both in two directions with middle schools, and we're also working with community colleges. The bill before you would expand the statutory provisions for the Rural Medical Education Loan Program. This is an old loan program that has been on the books for quite some time. The program actually has not been funded, unfortunately, for many years. It was replaced by a loan repayment program in the late 1980s, 1989. Took me a while to do the homework on this. And it was replaced by the Rural Health Services Loan Repayment Program. That program moved to the Office of Rural Health in 2009. Unfortunately, that program has not seen any new funding since 2009. And that has also been the fate of a number of similar kinds of loan repayment programs, which you were asking about earlier in this particular hearing. The Nursing Services Loan Program has received no new funds since the 07-09 legislative session. The Nursing Faculty Loan Repayment Program was only funded for the 09-11 session. So we do not currently have any active loan repayment programs, either at OSAC or at the Office of Rural Health. So we would be more than happy to administer a program like this. It would take a certain amount of gearing up because we have not administered a real loan program for a number of years. So we do encourage organizations and groups that are interested in loan forgiveness programs or creating a loan program with a forgiveness component to it to consider a loan repayment program. It is a far easier program to administer. It does not take as many years to monitor student behavior and collect payments and deal with non-payments, delinquencies, defaults, and so on. So I don't have anything more to add specifically to that, but I'd be more than happy to answer your questions.
Any questions of Ms. Deegan?
I think it was accidental that the primary care was not authorized for longer, and I think it's a high likelihood that will be refunded in this session, that it will be funded.
And that's a repayment program?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Department of Justice claimed there was no authorization beyond the first year, even though there was. And I think that will be straightened out. But it's a drop in the bucket.
Mm-hmm.
It's just really trivial. Almost.
Rep. Gillian.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think this is a great concept, and you clearly have pointed out the importance of it. My home is only 17 miles from here, and I would consider this to be a help to my region, let alone other parts of the state, including yours. So this comment, and that's all it is not an either-or, but I'm wondering about the partnership available from private funding. I'm thinking specifically of private foundations, for instance, the Ford Foundation out of Roseburg, perhaps the Murdoch. I think there are those, again, not in place of this, but in addition to any public funds we're talking about, I think there are folks who understand the need in the rural parts of our state for care that might be interested in such a program, either separately or as some kind of a partnership. That's just my comment.
Well, and I think you're absolutely right. And Ford has been very instrumental in our rural areas. Unfortunately, after the downturn, they stopped paying some of the advanced degree assistance. So that bumped up, you know, any help's good help, but that bumped it up for some people and added that if you wanted, it was kind of a catch-22. If you wanted to get the advanced degree, you were kind of on your own at that point.
Mm-hmm.
Having been, given the first 4 years.
Mm-hmm. Along those lines, have you looked at the Department of Agriculture? I know they have a number of rural programs designed to keep people in rural areas. The U.S. Department of Agriculture. That also may be something to look at. I know they have programs in place for educators, helping them with their first mortgages and things like that to attract people to the rural areas. So that also may be something to look at. But one of the really valuable things about this bill is that it draws attention to an aspect of healthcare that we don't automatically think of, right, and yet is critical. If you have a poorly run clinic, it's devastating, I think. And people, when you have, an inadequate number of delivery professionals, you're not making the best use of them if the clinic's not well run.
And I was lucky to visit OHSU during the summer, and we talked to several of the students, and they were medical students, so this didn't apply to this particular aspect of it, but some of them were talking about having done, what we all did in the 60s, Peace Corps, things like that. And they look at it, joining a rural setting as an adventure, but it's a temporary adventure. And they look at it, we'll get my student loans repaid, then I'll move on and, come back to Portland and practice, or San Diego, or San Francisco, Seattle, whatever. I'm sure not all of them, of course, but that's a big deal. Is some people, and the guy we talked to says, "Yeah, I can't wait to move to a rural area. I'm an outdoor guy. I like to hunt, fish, and ski or whatever. And I'm looking for a place where I can do that." And so, maybe he'll stay, maybe he won't. But that again was the medical professional, and it would depend too. He said on the pay, as he was married, had children coming. It would depend on their whole family situation and other jobs. And he said what really makes the difference, and this, again, I said medical, this is the doctor, they do have that loan program. He said it depends on what and this was a guy, there was also a woman, it depended on what their spouse and partner could get in their jobs.
That's a huge, yes.
It's a huge thing.
Mm-hmm. Okay, well, thank you. Rep. Boone, we'll talk
Thanks
about
very
next
much.
Steps
okay,
for this.
Thank you.
Colleagues, no other questions. I will close this public hearing on House Bill 2178. And colleagues, we are adjourned.
Yay.